Thank you. The last time I gave a talk in this room was in February of, I believe, 1997 at a wonderful conference in memory of Rudolf Peierls. It was a glorious event. A large fraction of the people who had collaborated with him over the past, I don't know, 60 years gathered here, and we had a really wonderful day reminiscing about him. And so it seems altogether fitting that when I come back here again, I should continue to be talking about Rudolf Peierls. In particular, one of the last articles he wrote in Physics World, which was in response to one of John Bell's blistering attacks on current understanding of the quantum theory, gave his own view of the subject, which was basically that quantum mechanics is not mysterious if you take the view that the quantum state represents our knowledge of the system we're trying to describe. Now, that view is not original with Peierls. Certainly, Heisenberg said it in a variety of extremely dramatic ways. It's hard to say whether it was Bohr's view or not. I have two pieces of evidence, both related to Peierls, that it was. One is that Peierls liked to say, well, that Peierls did not like the term Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. He didn't like it because he said it suggested there were other interpretations of quantum mechanics. And therefore, since this was Peierls' interpretation of quantum mechanics and he said there was no interpretation problem, he must have felt that Bohr took a similar view. The other piece of evidence I have, also via Peierls, is that there's a very famous quote, Bohr quote, that is bogus. Namely, Bohr is said to have said, there is no quantum world, there is only an abstract quantum mechanical description. It is not the task of physics to tell us how nature is. Physics concerns what we can say about nature, which is close to this point of view. The only problem is it's a quote from Owe Petersen, which appears in an obituary he wrote for Bohr and is prefaced by Bohr liked to go around saying. And I was very fond of that quote, and I knew it was from Owe Petersen, and I always said this is what Owe Petersen said Bohr said. And everything was fine until I was giving a physics colloquium at MIT about 15 years ago, and I got to the Owe Petersen quote, and Weisskopf, who was sitting in the front row, leaped to his feet and said, Bohr could never have said anything like that. It's an outrage. It's an absolute outrage that you even suggest, even if it's only through Owe Petersen, that fool who could have maligned Bohr in this way. Well, Weisskopf was a postdoc with Bohr, so I stopped quoting Owe Petersen. Until the last time I saw Peierls in Oxford, and I started to tell him this story about how Weisskopf had pounced on me. And I got as far as the Petersen statement of what Bohr used to say. And Peierls said, yes, yes, he said, that's exactly what Bohr used to say. So on that basis, I believe that Bohr also took this view. Peierls, however, in contrast to the others, actually addressed the question which is the title of my talk. Namely, he raised the question of whose knowledge and answered it. He said the density matrices that describe a system may differ as the nature and amount of knowledge may differ. People may have observed the system by different methods with more or less accuracy. They may have seen part of the results of another physicist. But there are limitations to the extent, on the extent to which their knowledge may differ. And then he said, this limitation can be compactly and conveniently expressed by the condition that the density matrices used by the two observers must commute with each other. That's in his Physics World article. It's also in his wonderful book of essays, which I recommend to everybody. It's actually a two-volume book, Surprises in Theoretical Physics and More Surprises in Theoretical Physics. And he talks about this in More Surprises, where he also adds, at the same time, two observers should not contradict each other, which means that the product of the two density matrices should not be zero. This is a fairly trivial consequence of this. Although the first condition had a kind of nice feel to it, I could never quite see why it should hold generally. And there was a time, Piles died before I could ask him, but there was a time when I used to go around cornering people and saying, why should the density matrices available to two different observers with different subsets of the total body of knowledge have to commute with each other? And people would say, yes, nice, David. Very nice question, and go on about their business until I put the question to Chris Fuchs. And he said he'd think about it. And I would remind him by email every now and then. It was the most positive response I got yet. And finally, after about 6 months, he sent me an email saying, the reason you can't understand Pyle's condition is that it's not true. And he sent me a counterexample to that condition. And I thought, I came up with a whole bunch of objections that the Pyle's within me would make to his counterexample. But I finally was able to cast his counterexample in a form which I'm persuaded Pyle's would have accepted. So the first thing I want to do is tell you about that first Pyle's condition, why the density matrices should commute, and the counterexample, I think, would have persuaded Pyle's that he was wrong. So let me first just sort of warm you up, give you an argument as to show you a situation where it works. Suppose Alice and Bob each know the two qubits are in a pure entangled state. This limit on theta means it's entangled but not maximally entangled. Both will then use, if they both know this, then they'll both use the same density matrix for the qubit on the left, which is just the reduced density matrix, which has a form like this. But if Alice now measures the qubit on the right, depending on the outcome, she can update her knowledge of the qubit on the left, either to this pure state or this pure state. But if she tells Bob nothing about what she's done to the qubit on the right, and Bob needn't even know whether she's done anything at all, Bob has no information on the basis to update his density matrix, which remains this combination of the projection operator on 0 and 1, and indeed it commutes with the two possibilities that Alice knows. And what I was searching for was a way of generalizing that kind of argument, but you can't. And all you have to do to get the Fuchs counterexample is to, depending on how you like to describe things, either say, suppose Alice instead measures the qubit on the right in some other basis, or to sort of invert the procedure advocated in a talk yesterday, suppose Alice applies a unitary transformation before she measures the qubit on the right. So suppose she applies a unitary transformation that takes 0 into 0 plus 1 and 1 into 0 minus 1. So the state now looks like this, which you can rewrite in a form like this. And so far, of course, the reduced density matrices aren't changed by this. Bob and Alice still have the same reduced density matrix for the qubit on the left. But now if Alice measures the qubit on the right, depending on the outcome, she can update per density matrix either into a projection operator on this pure state or on this pure state. And if you just multiply things out, you get that the new Alice density matrix is Bob's density matrix plus a correction, plus or minus a correction, depending on what outcome she gets. That doesn't commute with Bob's density matrix. So one has a counterexample to Pyle's. I think it's the kind of objection you might make to a counterexample is that Alice's action that she takes to get the additional information somehow changes the character of the system that Bob is describing. But Pyle's would not say that in this case, because Pyle's firmly held the view that in an Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen situation, whatever you did to the qubit over here did not change in any way the objective character of the qubit over there. It just changed your knowledge. So I think in this EPR form, Pyle's would have had to admit that he was wrong. I'm just sorry he's not here to rise and object at this point and explain why he was right after all. But as far as I can see, he was simply wrong. It turns out his other condition, that the product of the density matrices should be non-zero, can still be proved even without the first condition. It's an expression of the statement that there should be no measurement outcome to which Alice's density matrix gives a probability zero, whereas Bob's density matrix gives a probability one. So there should be no measurement outcome which one of them is certain can't happen and the other is certain must happen. And you can show that even though the density matrices don't commute. So anyway, I wrote a little paper about this and posted it on archive.org. And ending with a question, namely, is there any condition more general than Pyle's second condition? And within a week, I received an answer from Todd Brunn and an answer from Jerry Finkelstein, both giving a condition, a generalization of Pyle's second condition. And they both seemed very reasonable, and they were different. And I thought about it for a while and came up with a proof that although they looked different, they were actually the same. So we wrote a tripartite paper. It was only after we wrote the tripartite paper that I learned from Carl Caves that my proof that their two conditions were the same had been given by Schrödinger in 1936. But at that point it was too late. I was a co-author, a member of the consortium. So what I want to do is tell you next how we tried to generalize Pyle's condition. Well, what we basically, I should say what my two collaborators basically did was to generalize this EPR kind of argument I had written down to a case of three subsystems. So we want to know subsystems. So we want to know Alice and Bob both have density matrices for a system S, and they wrote down a very general family of density matrices that obviously didn't commute with each other, and argued that there were circumstances under which indeed rho A would express Alice's knowledge of S and rho B would express Bob's. And here's the general form for rho A, for Alice and Bob's density matrix. You simply take any two density matrices that have an expansion in some set of states, phi and phi I, phi AI for Alice, phi BI for Bob, but phi the same for both of them. These expansions, it's necessary to emphasize, are not in general in orthogonal states, and therefore are not necessarily unique. But what's crucial is that they should share at least one state in common. So the probabilities PA and PB have to be positive. These other probabilities may or may not be positive. In general, there's no earthly reason why these two density matrices should commute with each other. Nevertheless, there are circumstances under which Alice will assign rho A to the system S, and Bob will assign rho B. So far, I'm just talking about a system S. Did I say three systems? I forget. Anyway, I'm about to introduce two other systems, whereas in my original counterexample, I only introduced one other system. So, here we go. Now, here are the circumstances. We have two more systems, SA and SB. In addition to the system S, Alice has access to SA, Bob has access to SB. And we write down orthonormal bases for both of the other two systems. And we let both Alice and Bob's initial knowledge of the tripartite system be described by a particular pure state. Here it is. So they both know that the tripartite system was prepared in such a way that this is its pure state. And now if you put in the coefficients of the expansion in terms of the probabilities appearing in those density matrices you want to reproduce, and you say that Alice has only access to SA, Bob has only access to SB, neither has access to the system S, which you don't want them to disturb. You just want to see how much each can learn from measurements made on the subsystem available to them. So if all this is so, and they all know that all this is so, then if Alice measures an observable capital A on SA, whose eigenstates are the AIs appearing in this expansion, and if she finds the result associated with A naught, which will happen with non-zero probability, and Bob measures an observable B on SB and finds the result associated with B naught, which will happen with non-zero probability, then, and if neither knows what, if anything, the other does, then, of course what happens is Alice, on the basis of her measurement, assigns to SB plus S this state here, that leads to a reduced density matrix for S, which is precisely the rho A we wanted to get. I'm saying it too fast for you to go through the details, but it's not hard to see. And this, by symmetry of the whole situation, Bob, on the other hand, will get the reduced density matrix for S rho B. So there are circumstances under which, if they get the right measurement outcomes, what they learn about the system S is described respectively by the density matrix rho A and rho B. Notice that if the amplitude, the probability PA or PB of the common state being present in either of their density matrices is very small, then the likelihood of this happening is also very small. But it's not zero. So there can be circumstances under which those are the appropriate density matrices. So one has an enormous family of density matrices. As long as in fact, it's clearly not, well, it's not completely clearly, but it's one can show that it's not limited to Alice and Bob. If you have more observers, you follow basically the same protocol. You just start with a more intricate quadripartite state if you have three observers. And there can be circumstances under which each observer will end up with an arbitrary density matrix, provided only that all the density matrices that are available share at least one state in this very general kind of expansion. None of them have to commute with each other. So that's a big extension of Parle's condition. My contribution to this collaboration, which, as I say, was noted by Schrödinger, scooped scooped by 75 years, 65, that's pretty good, was just to notice that there's a very simple condition you can give for when a state phi can appear in the expansion of the density matrix. Let me not go through the argument, just tell you what it is. It involves the notion of the support of a density matrix and the null space of a density matrix. The support of a density matrix, the density matrix is a positive operator, so all its eigenvalues are non-negative. And the support of the density matrix is a subspace spanned by all the eigenvectors with positive eigenvalues. The null space is the subspace spanned by all the eigenvectors with zero eigenvalue. And it turns out that a state phi can appear in an expansion of this form if and only if it's in the support of the density matrix. The argument actually only works in a finite dimensional space. And I was puzzled for a while because in the Schrodinger paper, there's no mention of the state space being finite dimensional. But it turns out to come in implicitly in his assumption that the density matrix restricted to its support has an inverse. If the support is infinite dimensional, that won't be the case. Anyway, in quantum computation, all state spaces are finite dimensional. I mean, it's hard enough having more than 10 qubits, right? When we don't have to worry about a quantum computer with infinitely many. Okay, so I'm sparing you that argument. So we end up with a statement that if the supports of several density matrices share a state, then there can be circumstances under which they characterize the different knowledge that different observers have of a single system S. You can then ask, is this the broadest condition? That is, if there are circumstances under which several density matrices can characterize the different knowledge different observers have of a system S, must their supports share a state? And the answer we give in our paper is yes, provided the combined knowledge of all observers constitutes a consistent body of knowledge of S. I'm not sure we put it that way in their paper. And the paper, now comes the interesting, the paper has been subject to criticism by two of the conferees here in collaboration with Chris Fuchs. And fortunately, although in the paper we don't have that proviso, I carefully looked up some notes that I was writing for a conference that happened in Sweden last spring. And first of all, I guess the real evidence is this transparency, which clearly was prepared before I saw your paper last night, and has this rather more modest proviso associated with the yes. So I'm hoping that the ferocious attacks that follow the end of this talk, unless I'm wise enough to go on for 45 minutes, will be somewhat vitiated. So, of course, there's the question of what it means for the combined knowledge of all observers to constitute a consistent body of knowledge about S, which is an interesting question. I'm taking a kind of dumb physicist view, which is that there should be, at least in principle, there should be one observer who has a lot of data about various measurements of mutually commuting observables made on the system. That observer, having access to all the data, will realize that if among the data is the fact, say, that a photon went through a vertical Polaroid, and then later that same photon, nothing else having happened to it, went through a 45-degree Polaroid, the vertical part of the data will be thrown out, that there are no parts of the data that invalidate other parts of the data. And then the question, and then one has Alice, Bob, and Carol, all of whom have access to subsets of this complete set of data. Under those circumstances, we maintain that the supports of all their density matrices must share a common state. So how do you see that? Well, you say if the support remember is the subspace spanned by all the non-zero eigenvectors, all the eigenvectors that have a probability of being an outcome of a measurement of the appropriate observable. If the support is the whole space, the condition is vacuous because the whole space shares all states. So you only have to consider those density matrices that have non-trivial null spaces, that have non-trivial sets of vectors that they assign zero probability to. Now, if a state is in the null space of Alice's density matrix, then her knowledge, based on her reading of the data, is that a measurement of the projection operator in that state must yield the result zero. It's convenient to talk about that by saying the system cannot be found to be in the state psi. And if we now come back to the super observer, who consistent with Alice Bob Carroll, I'm calling Zeno, the last observer, who knows everything that all of them know collectively, then he knows that the system cannot be found to be in any state in a union of all of the null spaces. So each null space must be contained within the null space of Zeno's density matrix. But since the trace of Zeno's density matrix is non-zero, there has to be some state in its support. He can't assign zero probability to all possible outcomes. And that state is orthogonal to Zeno's null space, and therefore orthogonal to the null spaces of Alice, Bob, Carol, and so forth, all of whom are contained in Zeno's null space. And therefore, any state that's orthogonal to the null space of a density matrix is in the support, and therefore there is indeed a state in the common to all the supports. So we end up with the conclusion that we claim should replace piles. There are circumstances under which several different density matrices can characterize a different knowledge different observers have of a single system S if and only if their supports share a common state. When we sent off this paper, my chief concern was that it was a trivial result. I have the feeling I heard Ben Schumacher muttering it the first time I talked about it. I haven't been brave enough to ask him. Nobody else seems to share that memory with me, but presumably Ben, do you remember? You were there.
No, I don't remember him saying that.
Okay. It might just be my usual paranoia. Yeah. Anyway, I had this nagging feeling this was a trivial result, so I was delighted to discover that there were people who disagreed violently with this conclusion. The only violent one is Chris Fuchs. Who unfortunately is not here, but he did summon me to Bell Labs next week, so I'm expecting an exciting time there. Anyway, that's the conclusion. I have 2 minutes, yes, before the question?
I have 2 minutes and 10 minutes of discussion, if you'd like.
2 minutes and 10 minutes of discussion. Terrific. Two elementary comments. One is just that Pyrrhel's second condition, that the product of the density matrices should be non-zero, is a special case of this condition. So it represents a generalization of Pyrrhel's second condition. I'll leave that up there if you want to look at it a bit. The other remark, which I hope will also stir up a hostile response, is this. That if you apply this condition to a pure state, the density matrix for a pure state has a support that's only one-dimensional. That is, the only non-zero eigenvector is that pure state. And therefore, by this criterion, by this reasoning, one concludes that two distinct pure state density matrices cannot both describe the same system S by drawing on different subsets of a single body of knowledge. One concludes that pure state assignments are unique. Now, anybody who's learned quantum mechanics in the conventional way says, of course, pure state assignments are unique because the pure state is a property of the system, and properties of systems are unique. But if you take the more sophisticated point of view, basically the point of view of Parles, Heisenberg, and probably Bohr, that really is a question that ought to be addressed. And I rather like this way of getting at the fact that pure state assignments are unique. Often it's derived from the statement that if you know the system is in the pure state, your knowledge is in some sense maximal. And it's never been quite clear to me what that means, but it seems to me this provides a context for what it means for the knowledge to be maximal. It says that if there's this big body of knowledge and your subset of the knowledge enables you to say that it's in a pure state, then anybody else's subset of that body of knowledge, if it enables them to say the system is in a pure state, will result in the same pure state, and therefore the extra knowledge they have is irrelevant to the determination of the state of the system. So until I came under attack, I was feeling rather pleased with this. And now it's time for questions.
Patrick?
One comment rather than a hostile.
Good.
The situations in which the density matrix that one infers from the data about the system doesn't commute generically is, I think, a very likely one in the context of an extension of a method known as quantum trajectories or quantum conditional dynamics. There yep. You have a system, it interacts with the environment, and you infer the state of the system by measuring something on the state of the environment. Mm-hmm. Quantum trajectories happens when you measure the environment completely. Mm-hmm. Decoherence happens when you ignore the environment completely.
Trace it out. Yeah.
That's right. Conditional is in between. Now,
right.
There may be several observers.
Yeah.
They may decide to measure
yeah.
very different observables
yeah.
and there are pieces of the environment.
Yeah, and there's no reason why the density
and
matrix...
And then,
yeah.
in general,
yeah.
the density matrix will not commute.
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah.
you know, we are having a paper painfully rejected from first PRL, then
yeah.
PRA, on this subject.
I was not the referee.
No. Your rejection would have been a much more pleasurable.
Thank you.
Which would worry about the consistent, but we haven't been aware of you know, the extent to which you've looked at these issues. So I think it raises
strong emotions in certain quarters.
In the back. This is a question that I discussed with Todd Roon when we talked about the same stuff
yeah.
a little bit. And I was wondering if you had any insights. You have a question, essentially, a yes or no question you're asking. For two different density matrices, are they or are they not compatible? And one easy answer is any two pure state density matrices that are different are not compatible.
That's a conclusion. Yeah.
Pardon?
That's a conclusion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, how I look at it is, can you define some quantity? You can look at two density
yeah.
matrices and say they are this amount compatible. They are compatible.
Yeah.
What are the insights on
that? Some. I mean, another way of putting your question is that everything depends crucially on the null space. If a density matrix has no null space, then the condition is vacuous. because its support is the whole space. And therefore, I'm assuming that there are some outcomes that where the probability of the outcome taking place is strictly zero. Now, if the probability is one part in 10^100, then the condition fails, but one feels that ought to be counted as strictly zero, and is there a way of quantitatively getting at that? And the answer, I think, is the remark I made before, that under those conditions, the chances of three people actually arriving in a situation when they do this protocol we described, where those are their density matrices, I mean, they have to get the right outcomes of their measurement to get those density matrices. And the probability of this happening goes to zero as the weight of the common state, and the weight of the common state and their supports goes to zero. So the statement would be that under those circumstances, although in principle it can happen that three people have those density matrices, the likelihood of it happening, because it is an intrinsically random quantum event that determines the outcome of those measurements, is extremely small. And I'm not sure there are ways you could quantify it, but for me, extremely small is good enough.
Charlie, perhaps Bohr was trying to teach us a lesson that it was not meaningful to speculate on knowing what he thought.
I never met Bohr. I have no first-hand way of commenting.
Kevin, would you elaborate what the controversy
is? I hesitate to do that when two of the authors are in the audience, but our presentation, at least in the paper we submitted on the web, can be read as being tinged with a view that quantum states are more than a reflection of knowledge. We say things like, if Alice knows that a certain outcome is impossible, then nobody can get that outcome in a measurement. And I'm probably not saying that well. Is that okay? Yeah. And that suggests the statement, Alice knows that a certain outcome is impossible, can be read as saying that as a matter of objective fact, that outcome cannot take place. And that's contrary to the view that quantum states are states of knowledge. A stronger version of the objection is in a way similar to the question asked before. How can Alice really know? She can have a guess, but she should be prepared for the fact that her guess might be wrong. It was felt that in general, this point of view is in a certain amount of tension toward the sort of rigorous attempts being made by Carl and Ruediger and Chris to interpret quantum states as states of knowledge in a sort of strict Bayesian sense, where all probability assessments are states of knowledge. It's not clear to me that it's that incompatible, but finally, one of my adversaries wishes to speak. In the mathematical sense.
One thing you didn't mention is that there's very sensible different ways of saying that status finds are compatible or not. And one way we define is to say they are compatible or they're incompatible if there are measurements that reveal disagreement between the parties. So if there exists a measurement that will give an outcome that at least one of the parties, every outcome of the measurement will be deemed impossible by one of the parties. That's another possible compatibility criterion. And so we have a whole range of very sensible criteria that include yours, and so the at least the claim that this is a necessary criterion is what has to be taken with a grain of salt.
Yes, this is very much to be said that way. I think from that conclusion, I think that the conclusion from that it can be drawn is that quantum states, pure quantum states, are not states of knowledge, they are real.
Ah, and yes, I you of course would draw that conclusion to me. Yes. Yes.
There is a paper on that in the web that I didn't try to submit.
There are dangerous referees out there. Yes. Well, you know, I mean, that brings you to the brings one to the point of view that the question of whether there is more to objectivity than intersubjective agreement is a hotly debated and hotly disputed question. And will be for many centuries to come.
Other comments or questions? In, I guess, Fuchs's, Chris Fuchs's counterexample, the Pyros, was there any assumption that made for those states of 0 and 1 of orthogonality or non-orthogonality?
His counterexample was to say if Alice knows that the system is in one of two non-orthogonal
zero
states.
0 and 1, it doesn't matter whether they're orthogonal or not. In the proof or the derivation.
The crucial thing is that the transformation Alice applies to 0 and 1 should take them into two non-orthogonal states. And the way he stated the counterexample was just much more brief. It was, suppose Alice knows the system is in one of two non-orthogonal states, and Bob knows that too, but doesn't know which, and they don't commute.
That
I have the feeling Parles would not have liked. But
the only reason I ask is because the thing that you had on the right-hand side for the commutator, the two density matrices, was the anti-Hermitian as it should be. But it was also, it's an operator which is necessary to complete algebra measurement if 0 and 1 are non-orthogonal states. It's it's not a simple projective measurement, but I don't think that actually probably has anything to do with it. So it didn't really matter whether 0 and 1 were orthogonal or not, apparently. So right.
The two states Alice knows have to be non-orthogonal for his counterexample to work.
Oh, they do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is interesting. Any other comments or questions?